You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 24th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior fellow at Demos, the chair of the board at Color of Change, the author of The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, Heather McGee will be here with us. Also on the program today, world leaders express outrage over Belarusian opposition figure seized as the Russian-backed Lukashenko stages a fake bomb scare. UN aid now allowed in Gaza by Israel amidst COVID fears. Gaza, they have completely limited testing and only 2% vaccination rate. Meanwhile, in this country, COVID at its lowest level since last June, and nearly 50% of our population has at least one shot. Biden administration extends temporary protection status for over 150,000 Haitians by 18 months. Democrats seem to be prepping reconciliation for the infrastructure bill. Joe Biden's budget, however, drops any mention of public option or those cuts to prescription drug prices. Wall Street Journal report that the U.S. intelligence has intelligence on ill researchers in Wuhan, adding to calls for a probe on COVID's origins. Tomorrow, Joe Biden will host the Floyd family on the one-year anniversary of the killing of George Floyd, but he'll have no police reform legislation to sign. Matt Gaetz' ex-girlfriend is cooperating with the feds. That's going to be a drag for him. And in the wake of revelations of an unauthorized intelligence unit in the Postal Service, the Washington Post reports on another one in the Commerce Department. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. The beginning of the week. Let me just get this off the... Let me just start off by saying... My voice is gone for some reason. I'm pretty sure it's allergies. It's there's so much pollen in the air that I'm literally, I think, like chewing on it.
Yeah,
it's not even an allergic reaction, right? It's like literally, it's just you're breathing it in.
It's particularly rough. I mean, I've been waking up in the middle of the night coughing, which I don't even smoke or anything like that. It's the pollen.
It's the pollen. And now, of course, I wanted to continue to wear my mask outside, but I was afraid of getting beat up by Tucker Carlson fans.
So
now I'm just chewing on the pollen. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland, who has apparently the same issues with pollen that I do, but just not as extensive.
Yeah, I mean, it was a twin waking up of coughing and then just screaming at the top of my lungs. Trae Young flopped.
That's a sporting game.
The Knicks lost their first playoff game in 8 seasons by 2 points last night. Yes. Well,
sorry to hear that.
Yep.
Sorry to hear that. Wasn't quite sure where you were going with that, to be honest.
I mean, I told you before the show, but.
Yeah, I don't think I understood it then either.
You lost 2 baseball games this weekend. So.
That is true. I mean.
Personally.
Yes. Well. I mean, I was assistant coach. My son, it was tough. It was a tough weekend. With that said, This is, I don't know, is this a cautionary tale for folks who were pedestaling Liz Cheney, this champion of democracy? She was so concerned about democracy because of the big lie. Understand, I mean, this is generally true for politicians, but for someone like Liz Cheney, it really should go without saying, which is Liz Cheney is doing what Liz Cheney thinks is best for Liz Cheney. And Liz Cheney's agenda is not one that you could possibly share unless you are a deeply, deeply conservative. And I think in some instances, completely unconcerned with the idea of forever wars and denying essentially as many people as possible the benefits of society. I really don't know how else to articulate that in a polite manner. Here's Liz Cheney on with Jonathan Swan on Axios's HBO. It is impossible to say what she's saying and genuinely believe it.
You don't see any linkage between Donald Trump saying the election's stolen and then Republicans in all of these state legislatures rushing to put in place these restrictive voter laws?
Well, I think you have to look at the specifics of each one of those efforts. I think if you look at the Georgia laws, for example, there's been a lot that's been said nationally about the Georgia voter laws that turns out not to be true.
But even the Republican lieutenant governor of Georgia, Jeff Duncan, said that there was, that when this bill started to pick up momentum was when Rudy Giuliani was testifying that the Georgia election was a sham. I don't think anyone doubts that the reason 400-some voting bills have been introduced, 90% by Republicans, supported by the Republican National Committee. I don't think it's a coincidence after the election that this has happened.
Look, I think everybody should want a situation and a system where people who ought to be able to vote and have the right to vote can vote, and people who, you know, don't shouldn't. And again, I come back to things like
voter ID. But what problem are they solving for? Like, there's well, not, like, what look, are I all mean, these states doing?
No, I think, each state is different.
What was the big problem in Georgia that needed to be solved by a new law? What was the big problem in Texas? What was the big problem in Florida? What was these laws are coming all around the states, and, like, what are they solving for?
I think you've got to look at each individual state law. But I think what we can all agree on...
You can't divorce them from the context.
Well, yeah, but I think what we can agree on is that what is happening right now is really dangerous.
And I can agree with that.
You know, when I think about 2000, think about sitting on the inaugural platform in January of 2001.
Pivot.
Watching Al Gore. Of course, you know, we had won. I'm sure he didn't think he had lost. Mm-hmm. We had fought this politically very, very intense battle. And he conceded. He did the right thing for this nation. And that is one of the big differences between that and what we're dealing with now and the danger of Donald Trump today.
False equivalence. Go, Sam.
I if it wasn't for how much the pollen has taken out of me, I can't even tell you how outrageous what she has just said. I mean, we could work backwards. First off, she probably... just coincidentally reminded everybody that when you want to look to the closest analog in recent history as to what happened on January 6th, right, which is where she is in a rehabilitation project, you need only look to West Palm Beach, Florida, 20 years prior, when the operatives that the Bush-Cheney team sent to Florida to stage a mini riot to prevent the people in who are counting the ballots in West Palm Beach to go forward. If you want to look for the model for what we saw on January 6th at the Capitol in 2021, all you need to do is go down to 2000 in Florida in November.
They were screaming, stop the steal. It was the same people. It was Roger Stone behind that same propaganda project, just like he was in 2020.
Exactly. And then on top of this, how absolutely embarrassed do you need to be when Jonathan Swan, who really needs the access to these type of people, right? I mean, to do his job, is laughing in your face repeatedly at your complete refusal to acknowledge that the Republicans are basically engaged in a huge voter disenfranchisement project that is solely and totally inspired by Donald Trump pretending that the election was stolen. I mean, there, you know, he gives her three states and she said, well, you got to look at each state in context. All right. So what about Georgia? Well, you know, I mean, look, Liz Cheney, as wretched as you may think that everyone supporting Donald Trump is, Liz Cheney is the same, except for that one issue, which is solely a function of her trying to brand herself as the Pepsi to Donald Trump's Coke. They're both colas, folks. It's just that they're just trying to wrap themselves in a slightly different veneer. And so, you know, people need to really be careful when they lift up voices like Liz Cheney's, because now what's going to happen is when folks complain about those election laws, other folks are going to cite Liz Cheney, who is no fan of Donald Trump's. They're going to say she doesn't see that there's a problem with these laws either. I mean, that's the way it works.
Yeah. I mean, as Swan was laughing about, there is a complete schism in her logic that you can't say that Donald Trump was lying about the election being stolen and support all the laws that are meant to prevent what Donald Trump claimed were the factors that led to the election being stolen, because it's just such shaky logic. So that's why Swan's laughing there. And she did say something like, you know, people who should vote should, and people who shouldn't be able to vote shouldn't. That's what they're trying to prevent. What does that mean necessarily? He should have pressed her on it. What does that necessarily mean? The reality is they're trying to make it so that people who have the ability to take off work, people who are wealthy, people who are white, those are the shoulds. And the shouldn'ts, well, say you work 3 minimum wage jobs, you can't take the time to stand in a 5-hour line in Atlanta. Sorry, no votes for you.
I mean, that would have been the question for him to ask, because what is her answer? Well, she's got to say, well, people who aren't legal to vote. Well, what proof do you have that there were people who are not legal to vote voted?
Then you're just backing Trump's premise. And then there's no difference at all, except for exactly as you say, the cola branding.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. That was not to denigrate colas, I should say.
I will denigrate colas.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Heather McGee after this. Folks, choosing the right charity can mean the difference between saving a life or not. It can also mean about just making sure that your efforts are being optimized, essentially. For me, the way that I have been finding my charities, I actually, to be honest with you, like there's really two different ways I find my charities. One is someone I trust who's been working with a specific charity. And then the other way is some entity I trust who has been doing massive research on these charities, and that is GiveWell. GiveWell recommends charities that have rigorous academic independent studies of the effectiveness of their program. Since 2010, GiveWell.org has helped over 50,000 donors find the places where their donations can save or improve lives the most. Here's how they do it. GiveWell dedicates over 20,000 hours a year to researching charitable organizations. They handpick a few of the highest impact, evidence-backed charities. Donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $75 million over that time. These donations are going to save over 75,000 lives and improve the lives of millions more. And here's the best part. GiveWell is totally free. GiveWell doesn't even take a cut of your donation. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charities you choose. Plus, they publish all of their research on their site. They do so for free so that donors can understand their work. They're totally transparent. They understand their recommendations. For me, I found GiveDirectly. I don't think it's related to GiveWell, but GiveDirectly through GiveWell. They essentially just do what that says. You donate money and they give it directly to people in desperate need, because study after study after study has shown that the best way to raise people out of extreme poverty, and poverty for that matter, is to give them money. And they know best how to spend it and help maintain and keep themselves out of desperate times. But they have other charities there that you may find more appealing, but all of them are rated based upon their efficacy. And all of the work that GiveWell has done is completely transparent. You can see it on their site. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $1,000 before the end of June, or as long as their matching funds last. Just go to givewell.org/majority, pick podcast and the Majority Report at checkout, and they will match your funds up to $1,000. That's givewell.org/majority. Make sure to select podcast and the Majority Report at checkout to get your donation matched. I wonder if like these Hello Tushy guys write this stuff just to see if they can make me blush at any given point. But folks, many of us, obviously, COVID is, we're, you know, hopefully on the right path. Things are looking good. Still, many of us scarred by the runs on toilet paper from early COVID. That is when I, on the advice of Kyle, signed up for a Hello Tushy bidet, and I've never looked back. See, there's a little bit of a pun. Hello Tushy's brand new 3.0 is a modern bidet attachment that is here, that is so easy to attach. You will, and it is frankly, far less expensive than I think people assume. It is a great way to assess whether a bidet is right for you. It's stylish, it's eco-friendly, it's easy to install. It even saves you cheap ass money, as they say. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself. Has the Smart Spray automatic nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. Like I say, you don't have to have extra, you don't have to have any electricity. You don't need any extra plumbing. You cut your toilet paper use by 80%. All you need to be able to know how to do is basically turn a wrench and those screws for the toilet seat. Super easy. Plus, Hello Tushy has you covered with a 60-day risk-free guarantee, a 12-month warranty. You can join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers right now. Clean your butt with every flush. Go to hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off, plus free shipping. This is a special offer for the Majority Report listeners. Go to hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. And lastly, wouldn't it be nice if you had a pocket-sized guide to help you sleep or to focus or to just be better, feel better in the world? Well, there is. And if you have 10 minutes, Headspace can change your life. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. It is one of the only meditation apps advancing in the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. There are 25 published studies on Headspace benefits, 600,000 five-star reviews, over 60 million downloads. Need some help falling asleep? Be feeling a little overwhelmed? I don't know, having just like trying to get calm, reintegrating into our post-COVID world? Headspace has wind-down sessions and three-minute SOS meditations. There are even meditations for kids. It's been very helpful for my daughter, actually. Headspace works on your schedule anytime, anywhere. I'm trying to get more into it. I'm trying to remember to do it when I can't fall asleep well. But also, I've been, you know, I'll do some meditations when I'm taking a walk. I always got to dual purpose things, as you know, folks. But Headspace makes it super easy to use. Like they say, there are 25 published studies on Headspace's benefits. Specifically, you deserve to feel happier. You deserve to feel more relaxed. Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/majority. That's headspace.com/majority for a free 1 month trial with access to Headspace full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal available right now. Head to headspace.com/majority today. Okay. Do we have Heather? Want to welcome back to the program, Heather McGee. She's a senior fellow at Demos. She's the chair of the board of Color Change and the author of her latest, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs and Everyone, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Heather, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hey, Sam and Emma. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for being here.
So let's start with the pools, because that is the metaphor that describes your book, I think, most easily. But let's start with the pools, because this was a story I wasn't aware of, and it really does explain the concept here.
Yeah, I set out to write The Sum of Us really to figure out what happened to the country that had invented the greatest middle class the world had ever seen, and then really walked away from that formula in the 70s, 80s, and through to today, and replaced it with massive record inequality. And I understood the how, right? The tax changes, the labor market changes, et cetera. But I didn't understand the why, right? Why would we have done this to ourselves? And the story of what happened to America's nearly 2,000 mostly segregated public pools in America helped unlock a little bit of that mystery for me. And basically the story is that as part of the New Deal ethos, we built these grand, lavish, but public pools. And many of them were segregated. And when in the civil rights movement, Black families, sued to integrate them, a lot of towns, not just in the Jim Crow South, decided to drain their public pools rather than integrate them. Moved from a public good to a private luxury. So, rich families could have their backyard pools and their, swim clubs. But that really, for me, became a metaphor, the drained pool politics that has been an anti-government, pro-market politics that has had racial resentment and a sort of demonization of public goods once you have to share them with public that you don't believe to be good, as its sort of animating logic, which ultimately has hurt white people economically as well.
Oh, we lost Sam there. So I think that's such an incredible analogy, I guess, or way to a prism to look at your book through. Can you just take us through, some of the social programs where essentially white people were kind of coerced into cutting off their nose despite their face, essentially, or were convinced that cutting the social safety net was more advantageous than, allowing black people into it?
Yeah. In my book, I have a few pages dedicated to all the free stuff that the government gave to white families in the early 20th century as a way to build the middle class, and how much of that was racially exclusionary, like the pools. And when the party that was the party of the New Deal then said, we're going to be the party of civil rights as well, the majority of white voters stopped voting for Democrats and their, expansive economic agenda. Lyndon Johnson, after signing the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, would be the last Democrat to win the majority of the white vote. I use the drain pool politics metaphor to talk about what happened to free college, right? Government used to pick up the tab for the cost of college at the state and federal levels. And as the college-going population became more diverse, we had this erosion of public support for generous state funding. You know, there was always room for tax cuts at the state level, always room for more spending on jails and prisons. But the idea of really funding the youth really fell out of favor with more conservative lawmakers and more conservative leaning white voters. And so now we have replaced free college with this debt for diploma system. And that's another instance where white and black and brown families are suffering as well. Always, as my book takes pains to make clear, it's always worse for black families and brown families, right? All these economic impacts of racism, but we can't pretend like, you know, the world is really zero sum and you can have profit on one side and loss on the other, you know, for so long.
Sorry about that. I dropped off for just a moment. I want to go back to Hinton, Rowe and Helper. The fascinating figure, both, I guess, pre and post-war Civil War. But let's talk about him pre-Civil War. And then I want to talk about him in terms of Reconstruction.
So Hinton, Rowe and Helper is someone whose book I came across in the research of the book. Basically, he was a racist white Southerner who wrote a book that was very influential in abolitionist circles leading up to the Civil War, which made the painstaking case that slavery had impoverished the white South. And I talk about it in the book in terms of the ways in which the kind of plantation class, people who are very wealthy through an exploitative economic system, don't really need to fund public goods. They don't need a middle class, right? They don't need things outside of the closed system. And that impoverished the South. And that was the point that Hinton, Rowe and Helper was making about slavery. And then, of course, you can see sort of parallels to that with today's, you know, not plantation oligarchy, but it's a similar ethos, this idea we don't need public goods. And ultimately, they're going to shortchange all that we hold in common in a way that hurts everyone.
Yeah, I mean, he pointed to the lack. He was comparing essentially what kind of services. I think it was in the context of libraries, if I remember correctly.
Libraries, roads, schools. Yep.
That existed in the North as opposed to the South. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, come Reconstruction, he's none too happy about the what happens there, because despite the fact that he didn't like slavery, he also very much did not like black people having power. So, I mean, we see a parallel too with voting, right? At that point, mm-hmm. when we get into the Reconstruction era, we see, I mean, not too dissimilar to what we're seeing today, but we see the Supreme Court essentially allow for targeted restrictions on votings that were meant to exclude black people, but also excluded poor white people. And these same plantation owners and frankly just the elite had not too much of a problem with that either.
No, that was the goal, right? I mean, basically, the point of the sum of us is to say that racism in our politics and our policymaking has always been a tool of the narrow, self-interested elite in order to convince the majority of white people to side with their color instead of their class, and to cleave the working class in half and make it impossible for the majority of the country to win the kinds of to take back power from the wealthy and the powerful. And so the attacks that happened, you know, in the sort of first waves of voter suppression after the 15th Amendment, created universal male suffrage, were really aimed at attacking these rising populist fusion parties that were happening all over the South, where you had, you know, landless black and white folks coming together to take on the big, you know, sort of robber barons at the time, and or who would become the robber barons, the big money elite. And so the goal was put together poll taxes, you know, enforced by violence and intimidation at the polls. And in those poll tax states, you had extremely low voter turnout of black and white folks. And that's kind of a point that I try to make about today. Obviously, when we talk about voter suppression bills, they surgically target Black voters. And yet, you know, it sweeps in, you know, lots of women, lots of young people, lots of working class white folks who are less likely to have a photo ID. And that's the way they like it, right? They want a sclerotic democracy with a lot of voter participation. And so the rules can continue to be rigged in the back rooms. That's the vision. They don't care if working class Republicans don't vote as long as they stay in power.
I want to tease out this zero something because why do you think, let's start with the zero sum formulation that you make in the book, because zero sum has come up on this program quite a bit over the past couple of years, particularly in the sort of the Trump era, and maybe more in what you know, that concept of the psychological wage of whiteness. But talk about how you, the fallacy that you see in the zero sum in the context of your book.
Well, that was really one of the first kind of light bulb aha moments for me, was a bunch of sociological research showing that white people increasingly see race as a zero sum competition that they are losing. And so anything that could help Black people is something that they will, you know, many white folks will really organize against, even if it could also help them, because there's a sense that, you know, there's only one ladder. There's only one rung on that ladder, and it's either going to be you or me, right? Profit on one side, loss on the other. Any gain for people of color has to come at white folks' expense. And that's really the formulation that has been used by the elites to divide and distract. And so you start to get, you know, you see it today in our current politics, right? You see it with the right wing's reaction to what is an enormously popular agenda from the Biden-Harris administration, which is to divide, right? To make the takeaways be the slim pieces of racially targeted help, like for Black farmers, for example, who, you know, because this, they don't want us to know our history. They assume that nobody will know how violently racist and exclusionary the USDA has been throughout its history, and denying Black farmers any kind of access to government benefits. And so we'll finally get a little bit of repair from that harm. And in a bill, the American Rescue Plan, that had something for virtually every family in America, you know, that's what they lead with, right? This is all just a big giveaway, right, to Black people, right? To get that racial resentment up and to make white voters reject what could be a generation changing, what I call a refilling of the public pool with the American Jobs Plan, the American Families Plan. This is massive relief to working and middle class families of all races. And yet they want to talk about Dr. Seuss. They want to talk about cancel culture. They want to gin up that racial resentment so that white voters will see it through a zero sum.
I feel like there's a little bit of aiding and abetting of this zero sum phenomenon in discourse on the left as well, right? Where it's like, is it class? Is it the economy? Or is it racism that's driving like the right wing in this way? I feel like, you know, intersectionality is a word that isn't used enough. But I mean, like, can you talk about a little bit about how we could view this struggle on the left in a more constructive way, as opposed to just treating it as a zero sum game, even just implicitly in our discourse about it?
Right, right. Well, this is that question and that challenge is something that animated Ian Haney Lopez out of Berkeley University and University of California, Berkeley, and Anant Shankar Osorio and I to design a project, which we called the Race Class Narrative a number of years ago, that's still living in many formations, including an organization called We Make the Future and Ian's Race Class Academy. It's this idea of, okay, so if you're trying to pull together a multiracial coalition to deal with rising inequality, but that has to tend to racial justice as well, what's the story, right? Well, what is the story that you tell so that you're not privileging one or the other? And what we determined was that a message that can beat both Trumpism and a colorblind economic populism that ignores race is not one that only talks about race in terms of disparities, but rather one that talks about race in terms of the way that the plutocrats use it to divide us, the way that race is actually a tool of the greedy few. And so you're both getting a populist message in there that talks about the rigging of the rules, and you are not being silent on the massive animating force in most people's lives, which is their identity, and the most potent tool of the right, right? So if you only give a sort of colorblind Sanders message, somebody can nod and agree, and then they walk out and they hear Fox News and Trump and all of that. And it, you know, they don't know what to do with that. They don't know what to do with the pointing the finger at Black and Brown folks. Is it right? Is it accurate? Certainly seems easier than taking on the powerful to like kick my struggling neighbor, you know, and to make myself feel better for feeling, you know, better than people who are struggling. And so what the race class message does is it helps to inoculate people against the dog whistles. And because it says that's what the elite does, is that they point the finger at Brown and Black families, at new Americans, at immigrants. And so the next time you hear that, you're a little bit smarter about what's happening. And so I am endlessly frustrated by kind of a what I think is a really stupid debate where some leftists want to say, you know, race hurts us. Right, talking about race hurts us. And it's like, well, then talk about it smarter, because there's no such thing as not talking about it. There's no such thing as not communicating about it, right? Because people are hearing it all the time.
Right.
If you're silent on it, you're just not fighting on the terrain that, frankly, we've been losing on for so long with white voters.
So, okay. So if, I mean, would it, and so, I mean, I hear that. And I think we actually had Ian Haney on Lopez on specifically for the project mm-hmm. some time ago.
Yeah, he wrote a book, a great book called Merge yes. Left. So it might have been that. Yeah.
And so if it is the case that and I guess it is zero sum insofar as that if we really include the sort of the plutocrat, or however you want to call it, the capitalist class on some level, right? Somebody's going to have to give up some of the goods.
Not zero sum as between people who are currently struggling. Yes, the wealthy are going to have to give something up.
Right.
But I'm sure they'll figure out a way to be okay.
I'm sure. I have no doubt. I have no doubt. But so on one hand, it's a messaging issue, right? Insofar as like understanding the way that race has been leveraged as a way of preventing or obscuring this dynamic where you have plutocrats, oligarchs who are hoarding the wealth on some mm-hmm. level. And in terms of like a cause and effect, right? Like, is this, you know, when we say like, you know, you cite the Great Compression, which is that period between the 50s and the 60s, when we had a broadened middle class, or at least a broadened white middle class mm-hmm. In this country. And government programs that were, everybody was fine with. And I think there's plenty of, I can't remember who out of Princeton did the research that showed that, like, you know, as soon as it was opened up to Black people, all of a sudden there was a problem with it. Mm-hmm. But what if this is a question of capitalism, just period, in terms of like, and that Great Compression, like Piketty argues, was sort of, that was the anomaly. And mm-hmm. that in this system, even if it happens to be race that is used in this context, I mean, does race have a unique ability, I guess what I'm asking, to be leveraged to make a capitalist system even more capitalistic, or I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get at, like, is the racism, which is just being used here, obscuring the problem with capitalism, and that, and is the idea that sequencing, you deal with these issues of race and then you deal with the issues of capitalism?
No, it's that lowering racist, inoculating white voters against racial dog whistles and against, you know, self-defeating divide and conquer tendencies will help build the coalition to take on concentrated wealth and power under capitalism. That's what I'm saying, is that it's not like you deal with the race issues over here as like qua race issues. And I'm not saying that, you know, everybody has to be less, we have to solve racism in order to to make any progress. But what I am saying is that we need, you know, we do need in our politics and in our organizing for families to understand that it's, we're pretty much the same, right? That like, you know, when it all comes down to it, we are all animated by the same needs and desires to live a decent life, to have our basic needs met, to have a shot at fulfilling our dreams, and that the racial stereotypes that are so endemic to our politics are what cut off human empathy and therefore solidarity. And I talk in the book about how there are all these dividends that we can unlock, solidarity dividends, if we can come together across lines of race to do things that we know are in our mutual self-interest.
To the extent that there, that it's not a zero sum once you deal with the plutocrats, in terms of economics and benefits that one can have in society, what do you do with the white guy who watched TV 40 years ago and was centered in everything he saw? Mm-hmm. And it, you know, when he called in for customer service, it was just, you know, it was a, it, there was no press one or two for this or that. Yeah. And you know, like,
totally. Well, I think what you don't do, is let that white guy's, you know, sense of grievance about that, like, torch the planet, right? Which is really what's happening, right? You know what I mean? It's like, we all have our issues, right? There are a lot of things I don't like, but I'm not willing, and this is the difference, right? I'm not willing to, you know, to vote against my own interests, to keep Republicans in power just so that maybe I might get, you know, I might, you know, not have to have a sensitivity note before a violent movie or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it's all out of whack, right? The cultural grievance. So what do I mean, I don't do anything about the cultural grievance because I don't care about the cultural stuff as much as, like, I want our economy to work. I want us to solve big problems together. So, you know, on the, I just want to minimize that as something that should be a determining factor in the greatest country on earth's ability to deal with
that. We're in agreement about that.
No, but I'm saying, you are.
If the idea is we want to inoculate folks from the argument that is going to emanate from the right about a broader grievance, right? Because it's the concept of like, hey, they're getting, you know, black people are getting special Obama phones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of that is like, they're getting benefits. And so I don't like that program, but part of it, or black farmers are getting benefits, mm-hmm. but part of it is also like that message in their minds is consistent with like, I turn on a Cialis commercial and there's a black guy there. What happened to me? I used to be centered, or, you know, it used to be like, I'm watching TV and whoever it was there was servicing me in somewhere. Maybe it was my mom. Maybe it was, you know, my wife, but it was so like, what is it? I mean, And I understand this is sort of outside that portfolio, but it feeds into those narratives, right?
Oh, it sure does. I mean, I think we have to give, I think people have to have a more durable, resilient sense of self-worth that is not contingent on feeling better than others. And the, you know, the exclusive, you know, white men are a third of the population and they're two thirds of the people, you know, in office. Right. I mean, they're, you know, it's just being the dominant culture, identity, class is not necessary in order to have a decent life and a good life and to be happy. And, you know, I think about it in terms of this conversation about white privilege, right? I mean, what racial justice advocates want is not to make white people afraid of the police and white people have, you know, crappily funded public schools and white people not have as much access to healthcare, right? We want everybody to have those things. But if what was really an important part of it was the feeling that you got it because you were somehow better than the rest of your fellow Americans, then yeah, you're going to have to give that up, right? You're going to have to give up the advantage But in a society that racial justice advocates are seeking, advantage is not the price of a happy life, right? It's actually, we all have those things. And so you sort of have to disentangle how much of the privilege is about just getting things that are scarce because we live in a brutal hierarchical society with, you know, where we're sitting in the bottom of a drained pool and we don't have a right to healthcare and, you know, childcare and education and all of those things that other countries have kind of figured out for themselves. Is it that we really have material needs? And so if you're not advantaged, then you actually won't have your material needs met? Or is it that you just want to feel like the society is saying, yeah, you are one of the best versions of humanity because you're a white guy? You know, I mean, I think that's what we have to do. So that's why I think we have to refill the pool of public goods, right? We have to make people's lives better. And then, you know, hopefully people will sort of loosen the grip a little bit because they won't feel, they have that fear of falling, right? You know, as David Roediger wrote, you know, this in a brutal sort of in a society with lots of economic vicissitudes, there was that feeling for the white working class, they could lose everything, but not whiteness, right?
Right.
That we want to make sure that people don't feel like they could lose everything and really test what is the material value of whiteness. When it is so high, people want to hold on to it, but can we make it so that you don't have to be white to have a decent life?
I mean, it feels like, and I know this is a little far afield from where you are, but the concept of American exceptionalism feeds into this, right? I mean,
yeah.
We are the idea that we're going to have what we need as a country if we don't dominate the rest of the world in some way. I mean, it's mm-hmm. really coming into the fore right now, I think, as mm-hmm. like, you know, we're reckoning with, you know, the diminishment of American, at least soft power and, mm-hmm. and maybe hard power, too, for mm-hmm. that matter.
Yeah, well, we threw it away. I mean, right? I mean, we've thrown it away. You know, that's a longer conversation about how it is that we threw it away and what race and colonialism and white supremacy have to do with our various adventures that have thrown this away and how much, you know, we are losing out in terms of economic vitality and innovation because we keep devaluing the labor of Black and brown people, you know, both in terms of internally, where it's costing us trillions of dollars a year to have these racial economic divides for, you know, sort of simple math reasons, right? If you have so many people on the sidelines, they can't be on the field scoring points, right? If we have so many people saddled with discrimination and debt and disadvantage, then obviously our economy is not going to be as productive. And you've got like Citigroup, you know, counting it in $20 trillion, you know, $16 trillion over the last 20 years, Citigroup says that the racial economic divides between Black and white families have cost us. So there's that version of it as well.
So is there a, Sam, did you want to go?
No, go ahead.
Is there like a marketing question when it comes to the Democratic Party in this area? Because like, I read Eric Levitz's piece a little while ago, which I think may have cited you about just avoiding white backlash when talking about policies that would be a little bit, you know, that would advance. Because I think the Democratic Party is, in the at least in the presidential primary, focused a lot on this would help Black people. This mm-hmm. would be beneficial to alleviate racism, et cetera. But, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of what you're talking about, these universal programs, they're not being marketed that way by the Democratic Party. And they're moving much more towards a donor class in suburbia that dominates and pulls the strings behind the party. And then they also are counting on, of course, Black voters and voters of color as well. And there is some of that. Like, I don't really want to appeal to this guy that Sam's talking about, who's annoyed that he has to press one instead of two. But there's also a lack of, I think, conscious efforts to broaden the discourse or broaden the marketing by the Democratic Party to the two people who might be on the fence in that area. I'm just wondering how mm-hmm. you reckon with
yeah, that. I mean, you know, The Race Class Narrative Project was our attempt to give Democrats a way to talk about race in a way that widens the circle of who was willing to listen. And that, as I said, you know, inoculates some of those racially racially anxious, not economically anxious white voters, but also that, you know, builds a multiracial coalition. So I do think that's necessary, obviously. I think an interesting thing to think about is, you know, for my nearly 20 years in policy advocacy, I saw the Democratic Party catering to the white moderate and the white conservative and fearing the white backlash, not in terms of its messaging, in terms of it, not in terms of shifting the messaging, but rather what it meant was that they shifted the policy ambition, right? They were like, well, you know, white voters aren't going to stand for a tax cut or universal childcare or raising the minimum wage. You know, that's not something we can even offer up because there's a sense of a backlash, right? And, you know, white voters are not going to tolerate deficit spending and all of these things. So what I'm happier about is that it's no longer like in the policymaking, this fear of the white moderate and this fear of what white voters will do. Because that to me was always just the most self-defeating logic. And, you know, with the proposals, with the American Jobs Plan, the American Families Plan, you're finally, you know, acting like government has a duty and a job and the power to make people's lives better. And that's amazing. Do I think that the, you know, talking about canceling student debt or something like that, only as a way to, you know, disproportionately benefit Black borrowers who, you know, have had to borrow more, not because we're like bad with money, but because of the racial wealth divide that was the explicit creation of racist government policies, of explicitly racist government policies. Do I think that we should only talk about it that way? No, obviously not, right? You shouldn't tell, you know, tens of millions of affected borrowers, this is only benefiting some of you when in fact it's benefiting all of them. But do I think that the white left enjoys picking those talking points, which are never the only thing in the fact sheet, right? It's always like the one bullet that's like, this will also address racial equity. Do I think the white left enjoys panicking about those messages because of whatever reason? Yeah.
Well, the reason probably is just implicit, or, you know, I don't know, like things that they haven't dealt with themselves potentially. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
What do you do with those who are not leaning on leveraging that the racism to fight these policies, right? Like, I, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, as we're looking at like the infrastructure bill try and wind its way, and there's a couple of you know, there's the Manchin and Sinema who have their sort of like a branding project. Then you have like a Mark Warner, who's out there, who's not necessarily, I mean, you know, leveraging this stuff. I mean, like, I guess my point is, if race is sort of the, to mix metaphors, the howitzer in the quiver of preventing these type of universal policies, what remains if you are in some way essentially diffuse the worst parts of that howitzer?
You're saying what is like, is there a principled opposition to an infrastructure bill? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah,
that is not about racial resentment.
Well, I mean, principled, you know, I may not like the principle, which is like, you know, we don't want to get in the business of providing any type of universality to people. But in terms of like a pushback in terms of a strategy, I mean, you provided in this book a strategy that deals with inoculating, at least to some extent, when race is used as a mechanism to sort of say like, hey, you know, you don't really want a swimming pool because you're going to have to be swimming with Black people. What happens when that, you know, I mean, to what extent, or is this something that we don't even know how prominent the, you don't want a swimming pool because, you know, you're going to track water all over the place or something like that, or people could drown, you know, like, right. Do we have a sense of how big that is, or has race been so prominent in that argument that it's just obscured that.
Right. I see what you're saying. So I think It's amazing. So in 1956 and 1960, two-thirds of white voters in America wanted a government job guarantee and a minimum income in the country. Right? Wanted the government to guarantee an income floor and a job if anyone, you know, lost their job or couldn't find a private sector job. Two-thirds of white Americans. Between 60 and 64, that fell almost in half to just 35%. So, you know, and then I talk about in the book what happened between 60, 64 in terms of the civil rights movement and right. March on Washington, including those demands, for example. So, you know, I think race had a lot to do with it then. I think that if you, you know, poke around in the social science data and see how, you know, being shown a headline that talks about demographic change makes white independent voters suddenly want to drill in the Arctic, you know, I think it's weird, right? It's weird how prominent this is. And I also think it infects things that we don't think of as about race, like our individualism and our, you know, sort of free market. It's like the free market's race neutral, right? Like you can be a sort of libertarian and be like, no, I'm the least racist person in the world. I don't want government, I want the market. And, you know, I've started thinking about sort of the logic of that, like when libertarianism grew up as a sort of mainstream ideology was when the public that white folks were turning away from largely because libertarianism is a largely white movement, the public became more diverse and the market is just a lot less diverse, right? When you're really talking about the market, I mean, ultimately you're talking about the powerful people in a market, which is the rich folks, right? In terms of who you turn to solve big problems, right? You turn away from the public and towards the private. And ultimately that if you look at the distribution of power in the quote unquote free market, it looks a lot more like pre-civil rights America, right? Than does the government even today, even though white men are still vastly overrepresented in the halls of power and government too. So I just think it's hard, right? You can't disentangle it. We wouldn't have had race, period, if it weren't for greed, right? So it's hard to disentangle our economic stories about who belongs and who deserves and what's right and what's wrong and who merits what from our core sense of a hierarchy of human value. I don't think we'd have such a low minimum wage if we hadn't started out, you know, at zero. I don't think that we would tolerate, you know, billionaires. There's a sense of, yeah, it's just a very steep hierarchy of human value. And I think it's really that animates our economy and it animates our consciousness about race.
It's funny when you said that about we wouldn't have such a minimum wage issue if we hadn't started at zero. I'm just reminded of a debate I had with Walter Block, who was a former Ron Paul advisor, who said, you know, well, something's better than nothing. And that was like, you know, that was the improvement. All right. Well, so lastly, what is the message can exist? I mean, it's clear, you know, so you need a message that will build in the sort of critique, you know, that is coming on some level, that racial leveraging of race. What is the methodology for that? I mean, are we talking about organizing? Tell us the second part of the second part of the subtitle, I guess.
How we can prosper together. How do we prosper together? Well, you know, I'm a policy wonk. I think there are so many policies that we need to pass in order to minimize the mentality of scarcity, which is where you really get the zero sum starting to be, you know, make common sense to folks. You know, I think we need to refill the pool of public goods. And so, you know, technically speaking, we need to reform the filibuster and move the jobs plan and the families plan and then make them stronger in a couple of significant ways. But in terms of the how to really get things done, not just in, you know, with the majority that Democrats have in Washington, but sort of across the country, it is about organizing. And I'm not a grassroots organizer, but I couldn't help but fall in love with the craft and the art of it over the course of researching this book. I went around the country and talked to dozens of organizers, and that's where you get durable consciousness change, right? I talked to a young woman named Bridget, a fast food worker, white working class, Irish descent, who would totally, you know, believe the anti-immigrant stuff and the stuff about Black people and crime. And she just, you know, was sort of a product of of her media ecosystem and her family. But it was through organizing with the Fight for 15 that she first saw herself in a Latina woman, as she said to me, and realized that it's not about us and them, as she said to me. She said, you know, in order for us to come up, they've got to come up too, because as long as we're divided, we're conquered. And that came through organizing. That wasn't through seeing a political ad. That came through organizing for $15 in a union.
Well, there you go. Heather McGee, the book is The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Thank you so much for your time today. A real pleasure.
Thank you both.
Thanks, Heather.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, and then we will wrap things up in just a moment. We are back, just wrapping up. Really fascinating work by Heather. She was formerly the head of Demos. She's still a fellow there, but had been doing great policy work for years. And
then I want to just correct them, because I said that Demos was quoted in that piece I cited, but it must have not been from her if she's still just a fellow. My apologies.
But I mean, I think, you know, it is worth, going back, or I should say, taking the time to read her book, the ethnography, a part of it. I mean, the conversations that she had with organizers around the country, definitely worth a read. And, it is very hard to look at the data and not see that much of the resistance towards, you know, regardless of what you're talking about, you know, something like a single payer healthcare system or any type of universality about any of these programs, is a lot of the opposition, not all of it, but maybe a determinant amount is driven by some order of racism. It may not be in their forefront of the minds of the opposition, but it is it is prominent. And I mean, just, you know, you look at that, what happened in between 1960 and 64, to have 35% of the population change its mind about it, the role of government, is pretty stunning. And there wasn't a lot else going on during that time other than a fight for civil rights. But Emma, that is our time for today. We will be back tomorrow. My voice will be maybe slightly better. Thanks for joining us if you were just watching on Peacock. And for those of you who are not, my voice is going to remain like this. I may drop out too. I don't know what it is. Sometimes I don't know why I'm dropping out. But we just got, Shore Wrap, Majority Report with another top-notch interview. I think the end of the year collection is going to have to be extended to fit all these interviews in. Yeah, we've had a bunch of really good. And then,
Sam, you wrote that one.
I wrote that one. I did not write this one. Majority Report wardrobe coordinator. Why is there a black guy in a Cialis commercial? Wait, you want to be the guy in the Cialis commercial? I was just using that as the example of... Mm-hmm.
Monday,
the older white guy. Right. By the time we get to Friday, believe me, the commercials are going to be, the references are going to be nuts. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member of the Majority Report, not only do we do top-notch interviews 4 or 5 times a week, but also, you know, because 80%, I mean, Ted Williams barely hit over 400. 400 for a year was just like the best batter in baseball. But we're like 750 we're hitting.
Yes. It's not necessarily a realistic batting average, but it is.
Well, that said, I got to say, Saul, 750.
Are you still pitching to him?
I got news for you. We tried to do the kids pitching and it was a disaster.
So the point
is actually, this is actually a big controversy in the league.
Hmm.
We had kids pitching. I had one kid look at me. He's up at bat. The ball is going behind him. And he looks at me and goes, how is this fair? And I'm like, I know. Because the kids had all missed a year. So, but I pitched everybody. I pitched everybody equally when I pitch. Mm. You don't know what you're talking about. You're just accusing me of that.
Well, I mean, your son is batting 750 and then the other kid's like, the ball's behind me.
I didn't pitch to that kid. That was when the kids were pitching. That's my point.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry.
I mean, there's other kids who are hitting like that too. There's two or three kids who hit really well.
Well, look, you know, we know Saul is, he's got that competitive edge you were telling me about.
Yeah, there you go. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by joining the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, AM Quickie, check it out, folks. You get the headlines of news, 6 or 7 minutes. Gives you a good start to your day. Don't sleep on the AM Quickie. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. The Majority Discord. Check it out. MajorityDiscord.com. We've got over 3,000 members of that Discord now and growing. Also on Nomi's channel today, the committee, 3 p.m. with Aaron Chaudhary at youtube.com/TheNomiKey Show. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckin media universe?
Well, first of all, when the next 45 people subscribe to the Left Reckoning YouTube channel, it will hit 10,000. So that's really exciting. Also, we had Brandon Sutton on. We talked about masks as a sort of culture war issue and Supreme Court stuff. So check that out last Thursday. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get the post game. Oh, and I might Twitch at Literary Hangover tonight.
Wow. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there.
take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.